for this May 25th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Tuesday headlines. It has been exactly 1 year since George Floyd was killed by police in Minneapolis, an event that touched off a year of demonstrations, movements for police reform, and a renewed debate over race relations in America. Today, George Floyd's family meeting with the president as negotiations continue in Congress over a police reform bill that bears his name. The drug maker Moderna saying its COVID vaccine is safe and 100% effective in children 12 to 17 following a study involving more than 3,700 young teenagers. The company saying it plans to seek FDA authorization to expand emergency use to that age group as early as next month. We should point out the FDA already authorizing the use of Pfizer's vaccine for children 12 to 15. That took place earlier this month, and so far more than 600,000 U.S. children ages 12 to 15 have received their first doses. And the United States hitting another COVID-19 milestone today with 50% of adult Americans fully vaccinated. That according to the CDC. In foreign policy, for the first time since taking office, President Biden meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. That will take place June 16th in Geneva. On Capitol Hill, Democrats pushing for a July target to pass a massive infrastructure bill. And there's been some Senate movement today on a January 6th commission. Just some of the stories shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin at the White House on a day in which the nation remembered what happened 1 year ago today with the death of George Floyd, his two brothers, and the family attorney using the day to remind the nation what happened Memorial Day last year and urging the country to move ahead with what they're calling meaningful police reform. And late this afternoon, President Biden speaking about this anniversary and the state of race relations in America today.
The Floyd family meeting went incredibly well. We spent a long time together. I got a chance to spend a lot of time with Shiana and the family. And we just talked about, you know, it's 1 year anniversary. And those of you who've been through personal loss know that although every anniversary is your happy people remember, it also brings everything back immediately. Like it happened that day. It takes a lot of courage to go through it. And they've been wonderful, and I've spoken with the negotiators. I'm hopeful that sometime after Memorial Day we'll have an agreement on the George Floyd legislation, and so I'm optimistic, and I think they spoke to them. Maybe they didn't speak to you, spoke to some of you. I think they were very pleased with the time we spent together. It was mostly personal. We spent a long time, I guess, almost couple hours.
What
have you just like? First thing she did when she ran in, threw her arms around me, gave me a big hug, and wanted to sit in my lap. And we spent, she also loved the idea that she said, I'm really hungry. And so she said, do you have any snacks?
What did you give her?
Well, we gave her, my wife would kill me, we gave her some ice cream. Right. She had some Cheetos, and I think she had a salt and milk. I'm not sure what the third one was. But they're in and out. I showed them all, and we spent time. I spent time showing them around, not just the Oval, but around the White House, and they were interested in it. Gave them all little mementos, especially her. I had a great picture of Gianna when I went down for the funeral.
That from President Biden with Marine One in the background earlier today as he was preparing to leave for Delaware. That following a meeting that took place this morning into the afternoon with Philonise and Rodney Floyd, the brothers of George Floyd, as they talked about that meeting at the White House that included Vice President Kamala Harris. Here's what they told reporters earlier today.
I'm going great. We met with the president and the VP. It was just for the remembrance of what happened to my brother, because this was his day that he was murdered. It was great. He's a genuine guy. They always speak from the heart. And it's a pleasure just to be able to have the chance to meet with him when we have that opportunity to. We just thankful for what's going on, and we just want this George Floyd Police Act to be passed for the future.
Is there any message? Could I ask you real quick? Is there a message you want the American people to know?
Because this the thing. If you can make federal laws to protect the bird, which is the bald eagle, you can make federal laws to protect people of color.
What about the fact that you don't have...
Now we will have his brother, Rodney Floyd.
How are you guys doing? Today is about the remembrance of our brother George Floyd, father, uncle, friend, cousin. And Mr. President, the Vice President, gave us a condolence and just keeping up, touching back on what happened last year, reiterating everything. They asked us how we were doing. Are we taking care of ourselves, helping counseling, and asked us all about how we feeling and what's going on about today about our brother.
That from members of the George Floyd family, also meeting with lawmakers on Capitol Hill, pointing out that it has been 57 years since the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964, pointing to that, but also pushing for passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. In a written statement, Vice President Kamala Harris urging Congress to, quote, act with a sense of urgency to pass police reform legislation. Like President Biden, she said more needs to be done to address racial injustice. Now, among the bill's provisions, it would bar chokeholds by police, it would ban on no-knock warrants in federal drug cases, and it would create a National Police Misconduct Registry. More from today's White House Stakeout with family attorney Ben Crump.
Ben, I have a question. Ben, GOP is trying to get buy-in from policing organizations on the George Floyd Policing Act. And that's one of the reasons why we're hearing that it's stalled. And that's the reason why it was not signed into law by the president today. What say you about the fact that they're looking for police organizations to buy in? It looks like it's civil rights versus qualified immunity. Civil rights versus policing.
We're going to leave here and go meet with Senator Booker and Senator Scott, two of the lead negotiators in the United States Senate, to continue to talk about a bipartisan bill. We don't think that it has to be one against the other. It should be that we all want better policing. We all want just policing where George Floyd would get an opportunity to take a breath without having a knee on his neck, where Breonna Taylor would get to sleep in peace without having her door busted open and executed with 6 bullets in her body. Their blood is on this legislation, so we're going to continue with this family and this legal team to continue to press to say, y'all, we have to respect the spilled blood that's on this legislation. It must be meaningful, and we can do this together. This is an American issue. This isn't a police issue or a civil rights issue. We have to look at this as a national issue that we have avoided dealing with far too long. I think, Chris, CK, it has been 57 years since we've had meaningful legislation. And we look back at history, we remember Jimmie Lee Jackson being killed in Alabama, and Martin Luther King and John Lewis in Selma using that as the impetus to get the Civil Rights Act finally passed after years and years of trying. We pray that history can repeat itself and that the death of George Floyd will help propel us to finally get meaningful police reform.
Do you have GOP? Do you have anybody in the GOP or any police union?
I'm sorry, guys. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much.
Ben Crump is the Floyd family attorney. He spoke to reporters at the White House earlier today, and this is the headline at Time.com. Quote, Americans have learned to talk about racial inequality, but they've done little to solve it. With more on that, Janelle Ross, she is senior correspondent for Time magazine, her piece available at Time.com. First, if you could, put the last year into perspective. Has the death of George Floyd changed our country?
I think that there are ways in which it has. I suppose there certainly is a strong case to be made for a growing number of Americans being perhaps aware or convinced of the reality that policing is generally uneven and more severe in interactions with Black Americans. Beyond that, beyond the point of recognizing that reality, which, by the way, is a reality that has been with us since this country began, it is difficult to point to concrete, firm changes. I was listening to the radio just a little while ago, and I heard someone make reference to, I guess, their list of changes since George Floyd's death, and on their list they included the fact that there was a black bachelor for the very first time on a reality TV show, which, of course, for people who love and enjoy the show, I suppose is significant in terms of the expansion of consistent access to constitutional rights. I think that's a difficult case to make.
It's interesting because your piece begins back in 1937, the Carnegie Corporation hiring, as you put it, a Swedish man to unravel, quote, an American quandary. It was, quote, the Negro problem. So explain that history and why that's relevant today.
I think I should say that, of course, I selected a particular moment in time. There have been multiple periods or moments in time where someone has undertaken a really significant, thorough, deep study of American inequality, American racial inequality, and the unmistakable pattern that seems to haunt this country and almost every measure of social well-being or economic well-being, which is that Black Americans are in almost every measure far behind white Americans. And that this is the predictable outcome of longstanding policies and practices that absolutely create that reality. In this case, Mr. Myrdal, who, as you said, was a Swedish social scientist who later went on to win the Nobel Prize, and his wife undertook an extended study, which they required the help of many, many, many other social scientists to complete. But after about 7 years, they published this two-volume study that examined what people then and often now refer to as essentially the Black problem in America. What is wrong with Black people? And fundamentally, right, that question begins to shift, right, responsibility and accountability for a situation that is far broader than any one individual could create. This persistent pattern has been with this country from the beginning. It has been effectively the net result of laws that have been put in place that were designed to create a permanent underclass, and that is exactly what has remained with us. This study, of course, details that, right? And it did that in ways that I think are in many ways what people, if you listen to people today, will say, you know, the death of George Floyd awakened me or alerted me to the reality of inequality in America. This is essentially what that study did. This is decades and decades ago. So when people express a sudden sort of realization or shock at American inequality today, it requires a willingness to dismiss the work and the scholarship and the reality that people have documented time and time again in this country.
But have things changed in the last year? Was the death of George Floyd a defining moment in our country in terms of race relations?
I think it's fair to say that it was a defining moment in that it certainly seemed to draw the attention and concern of people who perhaps were disbelievers or were not particularly concerned about this issue. I am not prepared to say that I see evidence of a dramatic change. The number of people who are killed by the police every year has essentially remained unchanged. The frequency with which police officers are questioned, deeply investigated, or prosecuted essentially remains largely unchanged. Those are the things that are, you know, fundamental to the question of what happened to George Floyd. And in the absence of that kind of demonstrable change, it's difficult to say that a lot has changed. People's concerns are nice, but concerns will not keep people alive.
The piece, part of a series available at Time.com titled Visions of Equity. Janelle Ross, senior correspondent, joining us from New York. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And now to Capitol Hill, Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, becoming the second Senate Republican to say she will support a House-passed bill to establish a bipartisan commission to look at the attacks on Capitol Hill January 6th. It could come to the floor for a vote later this week, according to TheHill.com. Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, the first Republican to announce his support. He did so yesterday. And a third Republican, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, saying she also supports the idea of setting up a bipartisan commission, but she is working to make some changes to address what she calls, quote, the flaws in the House bill. Also, a number of senators now privately sketching out some of the contours of a new infrastructure package, as well as ways to pay for it, that lawmakers hope to sell to colleagues after negotiations between Republican senators and the White House have stalled in recent days. According to the Washington Post, the plan is being drafted by more than a half dozen lawmakers, led by Senator Romney of Utah, Portman of Ohio, Manchin of West Virginia. Earlier today, Senator Romney said the group has come pretty close to consensus on some key elements of a blueprint, focusing largely on more traditional infrastructure matters, including roads, bridges, trains, and broadband internet. The full story is available at WashingtonPost.com. After meeting with Senate Democratic colleagues, this from Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, he spoke to reporters.
The bottom line is very simple. That it is has always been our plan, regardless of the vehicle, to work on an infrastructure bill in July. And that's our plan, to move forward in July. Yes?
Senator Schumer, you proposed a couple of months ago, you talked about encompassing marijuana bill. What's the timetable?
Senators Booker and Wyden and I are working to introduce legislation, and you should see it fairly soon. Yes.
You talk about other bills that you're trying to tee up here in the next couple of weeks, too, you know, basically putting Republicans on notice. Isn't some of your audience, though, Democrats, though, to say, look, they are filibustering these bills and we need maybe to address the filibuster?
Well, look, we always hope that our Republican friends will work with us on things, whether it be getting America moving again in terms of Build Back Better, whether it be on January 6th, whether it be on even we'd hope we'd get some support for such a fine person as Kristen Clark. So we hope to move forward with Republicans, but we're not going to let them saying no stand in our way.
Are you saying the infrastructure bill needs to pass out of the Senate by July?
Our goal is to deal with a big, bold plan in July.
That from the Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. Up until today, Democrats had said that they wanted to see some progress on a bill by Memorial Day, and indicating, as you heard just a moment ago, they would like to send the measure to the president's desk before the August recess. Now, the chance of a deal between the two parties appeared to stall over the weekend, that after the Biden administration cut its offer from $2.3 trillion to $1.7 trillion. That number, though, still too high for key Republicans. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki declining to comment on whether the president would support a $1 trillion infrastructure package. She did tell reporters earlier today, quote, the only line in the sand is inaction. We'll get some more details in just a moment. Alex Bolton, who is following the story for TheHill.com. But first, Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming.
Well, when it comes to infrastructure, it's no surprise we are now very far apart. We were pretty close when we met with President Biden in the White House. So one of two things has happened. Either he has changed his mind or Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have overridden what the president told us because they have members of their caucus who are now recommending $7.1 trillion in significant liberal spending, and it is a massive amount of spending on social programs. And to do this, of course, they're talking about the largest tax increase in a generation. Republicans are continuing to focus on things that the American people think of when we talk about infrastructure. Roads, bridges, ports, airports, waterways, broadband. The Democrats are trying to redefine infrastructure to include lots of things, and they have a long list of social spending on their wish list. So the meeting that we had with the White House on Friday, to me, represented a retreat by the White House from focusing the things that we talked about with President Biden, which was physical infrastructure. So if President Biden wants to be middle-class Joe and focus on physical infrastructure, then he's going to find a willing partner in Republicans. But if, on the other hand, he's going to be the $6 trillion or $7 trillion man with massive amounts of spending and huge tax increases at a time when inflation is roaring back and at a time that America's small businesses are trying to recover from a pandemic, then he is going to find no Republican support.
With more on the infrastructure debate, we're joined on the phone, Alex Bolton. He's on Capitol Hill, his work available at thehill.com. Let's begin with the Republicans, including Senator John Barrasso, critical of the size and scope of the Democratic plan. But there have been some developments today. So what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that a group of Senate Republicans who are negotiating with the White House plan to come out with the latest counteroffer to the White House proposal, which was $1.7 trillion. The Republicans, who were initially around $600 billion, are going to come out with something closer to $1 trillion, it's believed, on Thursday. And that's going to be their latest proposal to the White House. That was something that was mentioned to reporters today by Senator Roger Wicker, Republican of Mississippi. And now one of the key sticking points, though, is how to pay for it. And what Wicker has said is that this would be paid for by repurposing a lot of the money that went out to state and local governments in the American Rescue Plan, the $1.9 trillion package that passed under budget reconciliation earlier this year. No money would be coming from repealing any part of the 2017 tax reform law, which Republicans see as sacrosanct. They don't want to touch that. Instead, they want to repurpose the money that went to state and local governments earlier this year, and also they want to increase user fees. Although Shelley Moore Capito, the principal negotiator, Republican from West Virginia, says that increasing the gas tax at this point is off the table.
If Democrats don't agree to a Republican plan, is Senator Schumer prepared to go it alone?
Well, what Schumer told reporters this afternoon is that, bottom line, the plan has always been, regardless of the vehicle, to work on an infrastructure bill in July. He said that's our plan, to move forward in July. So he won't say yet whether that will be a bipartisan deal on the order of $1 trillion that would have Republican support and then be able to pass the Senate with 60 votes, with 10 Republican votes, or whether he would rely on a reconciliation process, a reconciliation vehicle, which could pass, of course, with a simple majority, just Democratic votes. The assumption is that if Democrats go the reconciliation route, it would probably be much larger than the $1 trillion that Republicans are proposing now, since they could pass it with only Democratic votes.
We're talking with Alex Bolton of The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. How much pressure is the president getting from progressive Democrats?
Well, they're becoming increasingly vocal. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts said that basically this is turning into a waste of time. And he says that the size and scope of the package shouldn't be shrunk in exchange for potential Republican votes that just won't materialize in the end. And what Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, another progressive from Rhode Island, has said is that, look, if I were in a room with Biden, I'd say, hey, let's just get going on this. I think the longer these negotiations drag on, the more concerned Democrats are that Republicans aren't negotiating in good faith. Also, they worry that the political dynamic may change. Right now, Biden is very popular in the country, but if his numbers start dipping, it'll be tougher for him to expend the political capital necessary to pass a package the size of which Democrats think is necessary. And that's something on the scale of $2 trillion.
But again, bottom line, the target for Democrats for the White House is to move on this post July 4th, correct?
Chuck Schumer says that's always been the plan. It's actually been kind of vague as to whether that was the plan or not. But I think what's significant today is that Schumer says this is what we're going to do. We're, no matter what happens, whether it's by reconciliation or some sort of bipartisan deal, we will be moving infrastructure in July.
The story at thehill.com, Alex Bolton, who's on Capitol Hill this Tuesday. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow closing down, losing 81.5 points. The S&P off by 9. The NASDAQ lost 14. And you're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Tuesday, also available as a podcast. Just a side note, here are some of your other headlines. In Texas, lawmakers have passed a bill that will allow people 21 and older to carry handguns in public and to do so without a license. The bill now heading to the desk of Governor Greg Abbott, who says he will sign the measure. And here in our nation's capital, this Washington Post headline, a year and a half into this pandemic, ready or not, D.C. restaurants returning to full capacity. Adding full capacity could mean a return to waiting for a table with a crush of would-be diners. The full story at WashingtonPost.com. White House officials telling reporters today that China has not been completely transparent in the global investigation into the origins of COVID-19 and that a full investigation is needed to determine whether the virus that killed almost 3.5 million people around the world came from nature or did it come from a lab. The theory that COVID-19 escaped from the Wuhan Institute of Virology was initially dismissed by most medical experts and health officials as a conspiracy theory. However, a number of scientists continued to question the true origin of this pandemic. A previously undisclosed U.S. intelligence report found that researchers at the institute in Wuhan, China, where the outbreak originated in late 2019, sought hospital care after falling ill with symptoms consistent with both COVID-19 and common seasonal illnesses like the flu. It was during today's virtual briefing with the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, with this update on cases here in the U.S. and where things stand moving forward.
We continue to see decreases in the COVID-19 cases nationwide. Our seven-day average is 22,877 cases per day. This represents yet another decrease of about 25% from the prior seven-day average and reflects seven consecutive days with our seven-day average below 30,000 cases a day. The seven-day average of hospital admissions is 3,080, a decrease of almost 17% from the prior seven-day period. And seven-day average daily deaths have also declined to 501 per day. We are continuing to watch these data closely, and I remain cautious but hopeful they will continue to trend downward as vaccination scales up. This coming weekend is Memorial Day. I know that many of you are looking forward to spending time with your family and friends at picnics and thanks to vaccines, tens of millions of Americans are able to get back to something closer to normal, visiting friends and family. These are the events we missed over the last year, and we are now safe to do when we are vaccinated.
A little bit of breakup, but that from the CDC director. It was a virtual briefing for reporters. Meanwhile, during a congressional hearing, more questions on the origin of the virus from the House Appropriations Committee. Here's Republican Andy Harris of Maryland, Democrat Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the lead doctor investigating and dealing with the White House on COVID-19, longtime director at NIH. More from today's hearing.
It bothers me a little bit that we would send money to an institute that might be doing gain-of-function research, especially China.
I have lots of questions, but I do want to give you a chance, Dr. Collins. I think you were trying to pass a question to Dr. Fauci about the Wuhan lab. I heard lots of things like could, might, and not out of the realm of possibilities, really hard evidence there. I believe there is some white whale narrative changing trying to occur. But if you wanted to have Dr. Fauci answer that briefly, because I do have a lot of questions, I would be glad to give some time up for that.
Dr. Fauci, please.
So what is the question, Congressman Pocan, please? What specific question do you want me to answer?
Well, I believe the question Dr. Harris was asking is, you know, did we fund COVID-19? My bad. I'm paraphrasing it because we got 5 minutes. But that seems to be the new narrative that's out there, that somehow let's not worry about vaccinating people and getting the economy going. Let's figure out how to somehow say there's a different way this all started. I'm just kind of curious because I know you've had some interviews on this, but you were asked the question but not given the opportunity to answer.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Congressman Pocan. Let me first say that I think one of the things that was perhaps was the subtext of Dr. Harris's question is that why do any research in collaboration with our Chinese colleagues? Well, the underlying reason for that is that we had a big scare with SARS-CoV-1 back in 2002, 2003. Where that particular virus unquestionably went from a bat to an intermediate host to start an epidemic and a pandemic that resulted in 8,000 cases and close to 800 deaths. It would have been almost a dereliction of our duty if we didn't study this. And the only way you can study these things is you've got to go where the action is. So I often say, somewhat tongue in cheek, you don't want to study bats in Fairfax County, Virginia, to find out what the animal-human interface is that might lead to a jumping of species. So we had a modest collaboration with very respectable Chinese scientists who are world experts on coronavirus. And we did that through a sub-grant from a larger grant to EcoHealth. The sub-grant was about $600,000 over a period of 5 years. So it was a modest amount. And the purpose of it was to study the animal-human interface, to do surveillance, and to determine if these bat viruses were even capable of transient infection to humans. And the question arrived, did you do gain-of-function research? And as Dr. Collins clearly articulated, there was nothing in the grant application and or granting of the purpose of the grant and the description of the grant that would call for what is referred to as gain-of-function. Gain-of-function meaning taking a virus that could infect humans and making it either more transmissible and or pathogenic to humans. That categorically was not done. So that's the answer to that question.
That from Dr. Anthony Fauci. Again, his testimony before the House Appropriations Committee. It's on our website at cspan.org. One other note, the World Health Organization has said that the virus likely did come from an animal host, but the agency has not officially ruled out the possibility that the virus may have leaked from a lab. Secretary of State Tony Blinken today announcing a $112 million package assistance for the Palestinians and other humanitarian projects along the Gaza Strip, part of a tour in the Middle East that has renewed the conflict between the terrorist group of Hamas and Israel, the primary focus of the Secretary of State. The violence in recent days leading to more than 250 deaths along the Gaza Strip alone, including dozens of women and children, and an estimated 12 deaths in Israel, the Associated Press writing the following, quote, Secretary Blinken repeatedly alluded to the underlying issues of the decades-old conflict and expressed empathy for both sides, but showed little interest in launching another U.S. push for lasting peace, perhaps because previous efforts by past administrations have all failed. Instead, he expressed hope for creating, quote, a better environment that might one day yield peace talks. That from the Associated Press. Now, the Secretary of State's visit to the region did include talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. More from Jerusalem.
Reasserting America's role in the world has been one of the themes of your foreign policy. Can you describe how that took shape over the last 3 weeks in this part of the Middle East, where the United States had a very active role in promoting Israeli interests during the Trump administration, but had shut down relations with Palestinian officials? So what struck you in what you heard today from both sides?
Well, a few things. First, I think that The violence that we've seen in recent weeks is a reminder of the need to try to make genuine progress toward peacefully resolving the conflict that continues to divide Israelis and Palestinians. In terms of U.S. re-engagement, U.S. leadership, I think what you saw was President Biden leading very determined, very intensive, but also behind-the-scenes diplomacy to do the first thing that needed to be done, which was to end the violence, to get the ceasefire. And with a lot of hard work, with the efforts of others, including the Egyptians, we were able to do that. But that was just the starting point for something that I just described. It's now, I think, incumbent on us to work with our partners here and work with others, as I said, to address the urgent needs in Gaza itself and the people in Gaza, to then try to build something more positive on that, and also to address some of the underlying causes that could, if not addressed, spark another cycle of violence. So I think we found in working on this intensely, quietly but resolutely, that America's words matter. America's actions matter. America's engagement matters. I'm glad that we were able to help make a difference in getting to the ceasefire. And I hope and expect that we can continue to make a difference in moving beyond it and trying to build something more positive. So that's what I take away from at least the last couple of weeks.
Those comments from the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister in Israel. Tomorrow he heads to Egypt and then to Jordan. House Republican leaders have condemned remarks from Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene 5 days after she publicly compared Capitol Hill mask rules to the Holocaust. It comes amid a wave of criticism from Republicans and conservative critics, as well as Jewish groups aimed at the Georgia representative. First, her comments over the weekend on the Christian Broadcasting Network.
This woman is mentally ill. You know, we can look back in a time in history where people were told to wear a gold star, and they were definitely treated like second-class citizens, so much so that they were put in trains and taken to gas chambers in Nazi Germany. And this is exactly the type of abuse that Nancy Pelosi is talking about.
Those comments from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, again referring to the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, in a statement, the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy with the following, quote, Marjorie is wrong, and her intentional decision to compare the horrors of the Holocaust with wearing masks is appalling. Let me be clear, the House Republican Conference condemns this language. And in the Senate, reaction from Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
Leaders do more, either censure her or even expel her from the House for these kind of comments?
Well, she doesn't serve in the Senate, but this is one of a frequent outbursts that are absolutely outrageous and reprehensible. But any punishment, I assume, would have to be administered by the House.
That from Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Now, earlier today, Representative Greene continued to respond, tweeting once again her thoughts about vaccine requirements and the Holocaust. Quote, I never compared it to the Holocaust, only the discrimination against Jews in early Nazi years stopped feeding into the left-wing media attacks on me. She went on to write, everyone should be concerned about the squad's support for terrorists and discrimination against unvaxxed people. Why aren't they? Those comments earlier today from Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. After weeks of discussion, the White House confirming today that President Biden will in fact meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It will take place in Geneva, Switzerland on June 16th, marking the first face-to-face session between the two leaders at a time where tensions over Ukraine, cyber attacks, and a number of new nuclear weapons that Russia is now deploying causing concern here in the U.S. The meeting is expected to focus heavily on preventing nuclear escalation. Geneva, by the way, was also the site of a summit back in 1985 between then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and President Ronald Reagan. Nuclear arms race was also the topic back then. In today's White House briefing, questions to Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Let's start with Russia.
Sure.
Can you share any further details on the meeting? What's on the agenda? What does President Biden hope to get out of the meeting? And the choosing of Geneva, obviously Geneva is an historic place. So what's that part of the decision-making process in deciding to hold it in Geneva?
Sure. Well, let me start with, of course, you've seen the statement we put out this morning confirming that President Biden will be meeting with President Putin in Geneva, as you said, on June 16th. The leaders will discuss the full range of pressing issues as we seek to restore predictability and stability to the U.S.-Russia relationship. And to more specific to your question, we expect they will spend a fair amount of time on strategic stability, where the arms control agenda goes following the extension of New START. Obviously, we're both members of the P5+1, as well as those negotiations are ongoing. President will also raise Ukraine, underscoring America's support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And he will also plan to raise Belarus and convey our grave concerns, as he has now done publicly, privately, as he has now done publicly. It also is 3 weeks away, so there could be a range of issues that could be discussed during the forum, during the meeting, and we will, of course, provide a preview as we get closer.
And we'll be talking about Belarus in just a moment. That from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, the June summit in Geneva, also expected to include a discussion on those U.S. sanctions against Russian officials and Russian financial institutions. Those sanctions following the jailing of Alexei Navalny, who continues to lead the opposition against President Putin and for a while was on a hunger strike. He remains jailed tonight. Meanwhile, Great Britain and the European Union telling airlines to avoid airspace over Belarus after the country forced a commercial flight to land in order to arrest a young journalist. That weakened development, adding yet another strain in relations with a country that was once part of the former Soviet Union, remains a close ally of Russia. This afternoon, we talked to Elizabeth Brough, who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. In a piece she wrote for the AEI website, the headline is titled, A Shameful Kidnapping of an Opposition Journalist. She explains the story, her piece, and this development in our conversation.
So what happened is that on Sunday, a Ryanair flight was flying from Athens to Vilnius, Athens in Greece to Vilnius in Lithuania. And Ryanair is, as your readers, your listeners rather, might know, the leading low-cost carrier in the European Union. It flies all over the European Union and you pay very low fares. So it's a sort of airline that doesn't deal with geopolitics. It just transports cost-conscious travelers. And this flight departed from Athens, and as it was about to reach Lithuanian airspace, so it flew north, and on its way north, it went through Belarusian airspace, which is where you travel if you travel from Athens to Vilnius. As it was about to leave Belarusian airspace to enter into Lithuanian airspace to land at Vilnius airport, the pilot was told that there was a security threat on board, and he was told this by Belarusian air traffic control, and Belarusian air traffic control instructed the pilot to land to turn east to Minsk, which is the capital of Belarus, and land in Minsk, which is what the pilot did, because that's what you have to do as a pilot. You have to follow the instructions of air traffic control. And as the plane landed, everybody had to leave the plane. All the passengers had to leave the plane. And lo and behold, no bomb or other security threat was found. But the Belarusian authorities seized an opposition journalist, a young blogger in his 20s who was on the plane. They seized him, and they also kept his girlfriend, who's a Russian citizen. A couple of hours later, the plane was allowed to travel on to Vilnius without this opposition journalist. And so what that amounts to is, in a sense, the government of one country disrupting international air travel. Now, regular commercial air travel between two cities in the European Union to seize a citizen it doesn't like. And that is incredibly brazen, and to my knowledge, the first time it has been tried.
And as you point out, Ryanair issuing a statement saying they followed all safety procedures and protocols. But you write the following: how can the European Union, NATO, or the West retaliate? So the question is, what can we do? What can they do?
Yes, that is a difficult question, and it has been answered partly today. So the European Union decided collectively to ban Belarus-linked flights. So that's a quite strong statement. So essentially, Belarus is now disconnected from the European Union, both in flying in and flying out. And in addition, the UK did the same thing. So Belarus looks like a rather isolated country these days. But the question is whether that's enough. The dictator president of Ukraine, Lukashenko, obviously knew that he's not popular anyway, so he may not care that his country is isolated. And he may, in fact, have bet that that's what would happen, but he wanted to send a message that he can do as he pleases, because he doesn't care about being isolated. He doesn't care about being shamed by the international community.
Let me remind our listeners, we are talking to Elizabeth Brough. She is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I want to follow up with your reference to President Lukashenko. What does this tell you about him and about the Belarusian government today?
It tells us that they don't care what the international community thinks, because a leader who cares about what the international community thinks will not try to seize one of its citizens on a commercial flight, not even bound for the country in question, traveling between two other countries. You wouldn't try that, and you especially wouldn't advertise it to the world, which is what Belarus did. So he's not bothered by being seen as a rogue leader. And in a sense, he's similar in that way to Kim in North Korea, who likewise doesn't care that the world thinks of him as a brute and as a rogue, because he uses these tricks to get what he wants. And a leader who doesn't care about being seen as a rogue or a brute can do all kinds of things that get him concessions in return, because nobody wants sort of a complete deterioration of relationships. So if you have done something terribly inappropriate, then the West may reward you by saying, you know, if you return to the fold, if you start behaving, we may start trading with you again. You may get other concessions, and that might be what Lukashenko is aiming for.
The essay is available at aei.org. Elizabeth Brough from the American Enterprise Institute, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And a reminder, this program, Washington Today, is available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you have an enjoyable evening.